Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present economist Dean Baker, who assesses President Obama's economic team's approach to arresting and reversing America's worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. Celia Wexler of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who talks about her group's hope that the new Obama administration will restore scientific integrity to government. And Aziz Huq of the Brennan Center for Justice, who explains why he believes President Obama's executive order calling for the closure of the U.S. detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is minimalist and evasive. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
20 miles south of the capital city of Kabul, the authority of Afghan President Hamid Karzai's government suddenly disappears. Local policemen are nowhere to be seen. Instead, the streets are patrolled by men in black turbans, Islamic fighters looking for thieves and spies. According to The Nation magazine, the Taliban and other insurgents now control much of Afghanistan's south and western districts and have gained the support of local villagers tired of corruption, criminal gangs, and banditry. These are conditions similar to the rise of the Taliban in the early 1990s. The new Taliban is very fragmented and much more pragmatic than the group surrounding Mullah Omar that fled Kabul in late 2001. A number of the insurgent commanders who made their name fighting the Soviet occupation during the 1980s are now allied with the Taliban. These include the foreign fighters affiliated with Jalaluddin Hakini, who, unlike most Taliban fighters, has close ties to Al-Qaeda. Many Afghan villagers have lost faith in the U.S.-backed Karzai regime. Aid agencies say Taliban attacks have increased 50% in the last year. The situation in the conflict-torn Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, shifted dramatically as Tutsi rebel leader Laurent Nkunda, whose militia-controlled areas of eastern Congo, was arrested by Rwandan troops. The Congolese government has sought the extradition of Nkunda, who is wanted on war crimes charges dating back to 2005. Nkunda's arrest and the splintering of his rebel movement will allow the Congo army to reassert control in eastern Congo for the first time in years. Over 250,000 people in eastern Congo have fled fighting between rival militias since August. The capture of Nkunda also showcased a new level of cross-border cooperation between the DRC and Rwanda. For years, Congolese authorities had blamed Rwanda for backing Nkunda and his Tutsi militia. Such complaints were supported by a United Nations report. African watchers say the DRC and Rwanda had a clear understanding. Congo would let Rwandan troops capture Nkunda. Rwandan forces then would be allowed to attack Hutu militias who have taken refuge inside the Congo, forces implicated in the Rwandan genocide 15 years ago. Food safety advocates are going to have to wait some time for the new Obama administration to push for an overhaul of food safety agencies. Over the last decade, a string of food contamination cases have demonstrated the need for stronger government regulation and a higher priority for food safety. But various plans to reform food safety laws have never made it through Congress. The latest food safety alert is a recall of King Nut peanut butter, which was blamed for a nationwide salmonella poisoning outbreak. 501 people in 43 states and one person in Canada were sickened by the outbreak, and 8 deaths may be linked to the tainted peanut butter. Currently, Authority for Food Safety is split between two agencies, the Department of Agriculture, which conducts meat and poultry inspections, and the Food and Drug Administration, which does all other food inspections. Yet, the Department of Agriculture gets the lion's share of funding for food safety inspections. In 1999, the Government Accountability Office called for a single office to deal with food safety issues, but reform was never approved. Consumer advocates remain frustrated about having to rely on regulations giving food growers and producers the primary responsibility for maintaining the integrity of the U.S. food system. The government currently has little power to demand recall of tainted foods. In 2007, 76 million people in the United States suffered from foodborne illnesses. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
President Barack Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner won Senate confirmation on January 26th after controversial revelations that the former president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York had failed to pay $50,000 in taxes and interest over 4 years. Geithner was sworn into his new post as some of the largest U.S. corporations, including Caterpillar, Sprint Nextel, Microsoft, and Home Depot, announced plans to lay off at least 75,000 workers in the U.S. and around the world. The unemployment rate for December increased to 7.2%, nearly a 16-year high, with fears that the continuing housing meltdown and falling stock market could usher in a 9% unemployment rate or higher by the end of the year. In what economists declare as the nation's longest recession in 25 years, President Obama and his economic team will be working to secure congressional passage of their proposed $825 billion stimulus package and allocate the second half of a $700 billion bank rescue program. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with economist Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the book Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Baker assesses Obama's economic team's approach to arresting and reversing America's worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, as well as the corporate media's failure to effectively cover economic issues.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag. I'm happy with the stimulus package. It's not big enough, but it's a very good first start. So my hope is that they pass it quickly, and it will certainly be a benefit. It will stop some, or slow at least, some of the contraction. The stimulus is a good start, but there's a lot of other issues, and they're going to have to go beyond that. $800 billion sounds like a lot of money, but that's over 2 years. Relative to the size of the economy, it's less than 3%. Not trivial, but given the size of the downturn, we saw the fall-off in construction activity due to the collapse of the housing bubble was over $400 billion a year. And then on top of that, we're losing perhaps as much as $500 or $600 billion a year in consumption annually. So that's not going to be enough to replace it. So we're talking about a good start, a lot of good things you could say, but we really have a very, very big problem. And the question is whether they'll be aggressive in rising to the occasion.
I wanted to ask you, Dean Baker, about your book, Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. The roots of the current financial crisis are laid out there, and a lot of it you lay at the foot of conservative or neoliberal deregulatory policies, under Republican and Democratic administrations. But if you were to put it in a nutshell, in terms of the message there of what caused this financial collapse, how would you frame it?
Well, there's a lot of things that go into it, but what I would say first and foremost is that the Federal Reserve Board has responsibilities for preventing asset bubbles like the stock bubble that we saw in the 90s and the housing bubble that we saw in this decade, and they have all the tools they need to prevent it. And it was a conscious decision on the part of the leadership of the Federal Reserve Board, Alan Greenspan in particular stands out as the chair during this whole period, to just let the stock bubble grow. And he says this, by the way. I mean, he openly says this. He thinks it was the right thing. Maybe he no longer thinks that, but he, at least until fairly recently, thought it was the right thing, just let the stock bubble grow and it'll burst and no big deal. And whether he saw the housing bubble or not, my guess is he did. But in any case, they made the decision to let it grow, whether it's because they didn't see it and they didn't know better, or they did see it and he thought it was cute. It was incredible negligence. It's hard to imagine a more wrong-headed economic decision than just to let these asset bubbles grow, particularly a housing bubble. I cannot imagine what was going through his head and thinking if he saw the bubble and thought it was a good idea to let it grow. So there were a lot of other things that went along with this. There were financial deregulation issues that they allowed the banks to get hugely over-leveraged. They let derivative instruments like credit default swaps go unregulated. They let the abuses in the mortgage market, which were easy to see. This is not 2020 hindsight. You almost had to try not to see those abuses. He let those pass unchecked. So it was just an incredible amount of regulatory failure that could have at least limited, if not prevented, the damage altogether. But it was a conscious decision to ignore it.
Dean, what about media coverage? Obviously, the kind of string throughout a lot of our discussion tonight is the media got it wrong, and the media does a real disservice to our country in not going all out to get us, you know, good analysis and information about economic issues in general, and specifically about what's just happened in terms of this economic collapse. How could media do a better job?
Well, it would help if they just thought a little bit about what they were trying to do. I don't know how many times I talked to a lot of reporters, and I think many of them are conscientious, but some of them, they just don't use any common sense. I had a reporter with one of the major newspapers, and not a young one, that's when I just started out, who asked me a couple years ago about whether I thought David Lira was the chief economist with the National Association of Realtors, whether I thought he was biased. And I almost didn't know what to say to this person. He works for the realtors. I mean, I know David Lira. I don't have anything against him. I think he's a particularly bad guy. But his job was to work for the realtors. They're asking me whether I thought he was biased. Well, it's his job to be biased. He's not there to give them information about the housing market. He's there to try and make the housing market look good. And I just think that there'd be a little common sense here, and very often there isn't. And reporters just don't take seriously that they have an obligation to try to present information to their audience. And if they just thought about that for a minute, then I think we'd have a lot better reporting. But, say, they do what they do. They talk to those in power and just write down very often, almost verbatim, what those in power want to see presented to the public. And they never scrutinize it. They don't think, is this really accurate? And they don't try and say, how can we make sure that we're doing the best we can to inform our audience?
That was Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research and author of the book Plunder and Blunder, The Rise and Fall of the Bubble Economy. Contact the center at area code 202-293-5380 or visit their website at cepr.net. From breaking his campaign pledge to regulate carbon dioxide as a pollutant early in his first term, critics charge former President George Bush showed contempt for the role of science in government. In the view of many observers, he appointed political hacks whose main qualification was their loyalty to him and former Vice President Dick Cheney. Many of those appointees attempted to muzzle scientists who tried to disseminate the truth to the public and Congress about endangered species, climate change, and the impact of mountaintop removal. President Bush's appointees also demanded changes or omitted whole sections of government reports to cover up or minimize the damage his administration's policies were causing. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Celia Wexler, the Washington, D.C. representative for the Union of Concerned Scientists Scientific Integrity Project. UCS fought throughout the Bush-Cheney years to hold the administration accountable for its anti-science bias and actions. Now, with President Obama in the White House, the organization is much more hopeful about restoring scientific integrity to government and what some are referring to as the president's scientific dream team. But Wexler says not all the damage can be undone quickly, and it's important to stay vigilant.
What we've seen so far from President Obama is that he gets that it's very important that science be able to flourish and not fear political interference. And he's shown that in what he said, even in the inaugural address. He talked about restoring science to its rightful place. But he's also shown it in the quality of the scientists that he's appointed to head agencies or to be his top advisors. And he's also shown it in the kinds of process reforms that really, really emphasize the importance of transparency. Science flourishes in the sunlight. We know that the past few years have been very hard on science. At the Department of Interior, you had one political appointee, Julie McDonald, that really harassed and intimidated their scientist at the Fish and Wildlife Service, and that resulted in scores. We probably don't know how many decisions affecting endangered species that really need to be reviewed to see to what extent they're causing damage and to what extent they're not science-based. And that review has been ongoing, but it needs to continue and be intensified. We know that there have been a lot of Bush rules that have been put into effect that are very harmful, that the administration needs to try to reevaluate, even rules that have already taken effect, like rules that affect mountaintop removal, which is environmentally very damaging. There are other rules that just became final that will take away the ability of scientists to weigh in when other agencies are deciding about policies such as removing timber, cutting down trees, or siting electricity plants, utility plants that have an impact on endangered species. They've always been consulted before, and now with these Bush rules, they won't be. So we are concerned about the rules that have taken effect. We are concerned about the very low morale at the agencies. Surveys that we've done over the past several years show that more than 1,400 scientists have told us that they fear retaliation for speaking out about their agency's mission-driven work, whether inside or outside the agency. And it's going to take more than the head of the agency to say, well, things are going to change, like Lisa Jackson, who's now head of the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, a new Obama appointee who's been confirmed. It's going to take communicating that message down to the managerial level. So all these managers that have maybe some of them drunk the Kool-Aid and have really interfered with science have to be re-educated. And beyond that, we need something in law that says to scientists that whistleblowers won't be retaliated against. So we need the Obama administration to put some political capital and push Congress to pass strong protections for all federal employees, including federal scientists, who expose attempts to alter or suppress federal research.
Celia Wexler, some of the things that the Bush administration put into effect have been reversed just by President Obama signing an order, such as the so-called global gag rule related to abortion. But isn't it true that a lot of things that went into effect, even in the last several months of the Bush administration, can't be reversed just by the president signing a statement? They have to go through a reverse ruling process? Is that right? And that could take months or maybe even longer?
The new head of the Office of Management and Budget issued a memo that explained what the Obama administration would do about rules. Now, rules that have not taken effect will be delayed for at least 60 days so that the new administration can evaluate them. Rules that were in the pipeline will just be halted. They just won't go any further. Now, when you get to the rules that have taken effect, depending how long they've been in effect, there are certain things that can be done. One is that Congress can step in and use the Congressional Review Act to overturn rules. That's very politically difficult, but it can be done. And indeed, Representative Nick Rahal has already started that process on some of the endangered species rules. The other things that can be done, for example, is if lawsuits are brought against some of these more egregious rules, and there is litigation pending in some cases, that the administration can choose to settle. But in some cases, what a new administration will have to do will take time if it requires actually passing a new rule that requires notice of comment. There has to be a lot of procedural hurdles to go through, and that can take many months. But I think the new administration is exploring every single option. And if the administration feels that a rule truly jeopardizes public health and safety, then there are some procedural shortcuts you can take as well.
That was Celia Wexler of the Union of Concerned Scientists Scientific Integrity Project. Call the group's Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-223-6133 or visit their website at ucsusa.org. Soon after being sworn in as president, Barack Obama issued an executive order calling for the closure within a year of the U.S. detention facility at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. A second executive order formally banned torture by requiring that the Army Field Manual be used as the guide for terrorism interrogations. A third order established an interagency task force that will lead a systematic review of U.S. detention policies and procedures and review the cases of 245 terrorist suspects now being held at Guantanamo. Mr. Obama also instructed military prosecutors to seek a 120-day suspension of military commission's proceedings involving detainees in the case of five defendants accused of organizing the September 11, 2001 attacks on the United States. It is unknown if the new president will transfer prisoners to U.S. federal courts, have them face war crimes charges in military courts-martial, or modify Mr. Bush's military commission's procedures that the Supreme Court ruled were unconstitutional. More than 550 detainees have been released from Guantanamo, with many former prisoners charging that they were subject to abuse and torture. Legal and national security officials with the new administration have reported that upon gaining access to classified material, they discovered that there were no comprehensive case files on many Guantanamo detainees, and that information on individual prisoners is scattered throughout the executive branch and in disarray. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Aziz Haque, director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Haque explains why he believes President Obama's executive order calling for the closure of Guantanamo is minimalist and evasive.
Basically, what the order does is declare that the president is making a clean break from the detention-related policies of his predecessor, but then not say exactly what direction he will take after that break. So we have a clear enunciation of many aspects of detention policy. We have detention policy coming under the minimum rules that the international law of war requires, something called Common Article 3. We have the management of detention policy being shifted from the Defense Department, where it's been since 2001, to the Department of Justice and the Attorney General. We have a new emphasis on prosecution, preferably in federal court, a stopping of the military commission. And all of that is very good, and I think long overdue. The reason, I think, to criticize Obama is that with respect to the disposition, with respect to the handling of any given detainee's case, the order of last week says nothing. It tells us nothing about whether any detainee, any particular detainee, will be released, transferred to a third country, or indeed prosecuted in federal court. And I think that that silence is particularly problematic with respect to the groups of detainees who are concededly innocent of any involvement in terrorism. The most well-known of these is the class of Uyghurs, Chinese Muslim, who have been declared by a federal court to be not at all enemy combatants. There is no legitimate or moral reason that that group of people and others like them, and I suspect that the group of people who are in the same position as the Uyghurs is much, much larger than the Bush administration has ever been willing to say. There's no reason that that group of people should still be in Guantanamo.
We hear that Sheikh Ali Mohammed is someone who had been tortured, waterboarded, maybe worse, and that prosecuting him may prove to be very difficult in U.S. courts, given the fact that he was tortured and evidence or confessions or whatever he said under torture would be thrown out in any regular court. We're told that Adele Emelike, in KSM's case, we would have a choice between letting this guy loose, who's allegedly one of the masterminds of the 9/11 attacks on this country, or throwing him in jail and throwing the key away.
It is a complete non sequitur. It is complete nonsense to say that just because somebody has been tortured, you can't prosecute them. All it means is that you can't use the evidence gained from that torture. And that makes sense. That evidence is unreliable. Why would you ever rely on it? Why would you ever use it? Why would you ever corrupt a criminal proceeding with that evidence? So this argument is, at the very best, speculative. And at worst, it's made in bad faith. It's made knowing that this is not the way that our criminal justice system works, but knowing that people are afraid enough of people like KSM, that they are willing to back an immoral and ineffectual policy rather than face up to that fear.
I wanted to ask you briefly about torture. It seems that the Obama administration may have left a door a little ajar here in terms of their future policy on torture, in that they were going to review the torture techniques, the abusive or harsh interrogation methods that the Bush administration authorized, but leaving the door open a little bit that possibly they could carve out some exceptions in the future. When reporters were asking them about this possible loophole, they denied that that was their motive to institute some new form of authorization for torture. What do you make of all this?
I think that this is another good example of Obama's minimalism. It is the case that the administration has left itself some wiggle room with this panel or commission internal to the executive branch that will look to see whether there is any justification for establishing such an exception in the future. You know, and I think that one way of thinking about this is that what Obama is trying to do with these executive orders is to get the most good done he can at the least political cost, right? Which is sensible. And so one can look at his minimalism, as I called it in the American Prospect article, as a way of protecting his right flank. He takes the decision he needs to take for the time being, leaving, you know, he doesn't need to close off every door in the future to make sure that torture never happens. He doesn't need to answer the critics' question about national security courts as he empties Guantanamo by prosecuting and releasing people. And to close those doors would create political backlash, which he doesn't need to create. And so you might think that these are, in some sense, very savvy moves. That's a somewhat optimistic reading of the executive orders. It's not entirely unwarranted, and I hope it turns out to be right.
That was Aziz Haque, director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Contact the center by calling area code 212-998-6730 or visit their website at brennancenter.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Indu Anand, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.